The Guardian.
I wanted to know how, because we're here because of the Domino re-releases, and I wanted to know how it came about, because you were never signed to Domino. You were on Rough Trade, is that right?
We were sort of rescued in the 70s, late 70s, by Jeff Travis at Rough Trade, from sort of big dinosaur, aloof record companies. But then we went on to, on Jeff Travis's recommendation, a record company called Ryko, which got hijacked a year or two ago, which meant that our material was no longer available. And as I live entirely off it, I mean, most musicians live off their live gigs and then the records are extra, but I live entirely off the records and I don't make that many. So what I make do have to be available for us to earn a living. So we were really lucky that the publisher at Ryko had already jumped ship and found himself a publisher at Domino. And he said, well, why don't you come and talk to Domino, Lawrence and that lot of Domino. So we did and we got on well. And they said, we'll put out your next record and then we could put out your back catalogue, which is really nice for us. And we're very grateful.
But it's not all of your back catalogue, is it? It's certain selections. Did you have a choice in that?
It's most of it, really, since the stuff under my name, since the early 70s. I mean, I was a drummer for 10 years before that, and in a couple of bands, and there's a couple of LPs from that period, which I think Universal are putting out again sometime. But we don't have much to do with that. We have no control over that. And there are BBC tapes, John Peel tapes related to that, which are around. And there's a little record company in States called Cuneiform, which put out a sort of hodgepodge, bits of pieces of mine. But on the whole, it is my catalogue since the 70s. Yeah, it is most of it.
How, I mean, will they be reissuing artwork or sleeve notes or anything, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, what's good is that what Domino have done, apart from reissuing the CDs with all Alfie's artwork, they're also putting them out on vinyl, most of the stuff on vinyl, apart from an EP's box set, which just didn't make sense in vinyl format, because it is a bunch of EPs. Which is really not funny enough. It's funny to see a couple of the records, like Live at Drury Lane, which were never anything other than CD. Ryko only did CDs. So it's funny, a nice sort of backwards way around. These records come out on... thanks, Alfie. Thank you very much. on vinyl LP, well into the 21st century. I love that kind of thing. But they're doing it, you know, it's really nice for me that they're doing that.
So did you have...
And it's also very nice for Alfie's artwork, I think, which, you know, it's nice to see it bigger.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, Alfie, not just with the artwork, but she's hugely involved with your writing to this day. Is it nice to have her sort of credited for that?
Yeah, well, she's half the story now. I mean, in the sense that my records aren't really solo records. They are kind of... We're a double act, but she's sort of a bit shyer than me, and she slightly disapproves of my ostentatious tendencies, which she's tried to curb by stopping me drinking and stuff. So who knows how I'll behave in the future. But, yeah, she does a lot of it. I mean, I started taking her words. She didn't offer them. I just nicked them, really, for some of the songs. And she's done about 16 now. And eventually she did start writing bits and pieces, actually for tunes that I already had written. So it's sort of half and half now, I think, that sometimes she'll do words, I put music to it, or I'll do music and she'll put words to it. And it's good for me, because I've got much more musical ideas than I have word ideas. Though you wouldn't think so, well, I rab it on, but writing songs is different.
Is it, I wondered whether that was, you're saying, you know, you've been part of, you know, half of a team with Alfie, because obviously you started off as part of a group, and actually, as far as I'm aware, going solo was not really a choice of yours. Is that the case with it when you left Soft Machine?
Yeah, I was kicked out of Soft Machine, and then I got a little band together myself without much money called Matchy Mole, and we made a couple of LPs and did a few concerts. before we, but then I did when I broke my back before on the while I was still trying writing stuff for the third Matrimonial LP, it became obvious I couldn't ask the rest of the band to hang on while I was in hospital. I was there nearly a year, so you know, I couldn't pay them, so you know, I had to let them get on with their lives. And so in a way that was forced on me, but necessity being the mother of what's it, I suddenly found that if you're making records, you don't really have to be in a group. And as since I found out fairly early on, I did a few live gigs that it was really hard in a wheelchair to get about and organise stuff, and you know, just the logistics of getting from one place to another and checking out the venues if they're wheelchair friendly, it was too much of a, it wasn't fun. So I thought, well, I'd just make records. And for that, as I say, you can just choose the people you want for each tune, really. And the good thing about that is you can work with people who you wouldn't necessarily want to live with for month after month. I mean, I saw some group on the front of a pop magazine just now. I was looking around the magazine shop, newspaper shop, and with some groups talking about why they broke up. He said, look, it's four of us sitting around staring at each other for 5 years. Of course, they all bloody hate each other. And you can see, well, yeah, you know, you can see that. I mean, young testosterone fueled men, I mean, the only thing, what can you do with them? Send them off to go and kill foreigners is the usual solution. Or plan B, put them in a rock group. And, you know, what can you do with this? God help us. So there we are. And so it's a mixed blessing. I feel now, in retrospect, sort of released from national service in group world.
But do you miss playing live?
Well, I thought I didn't, but actually, one of these things that's been re-released is a live concert at Drury Lane in '74,
which John Peel compared.
He did, and when I hear the way all the musicians on it, we're all sort of spurring each other on into a kind of madness for over an hour period. I think, yeah, that was good, and it's very hard to get that anywhere else but live, you know, with the audience who really sort of, if they're on your side, you know. And so I thought, yeah, you know,
And do you like being, because I know I've seen quite a lot of footage of you really, really going at it on the drum kit in Soft Machine, as we said, standing up the full.
Yeah, I did have a, I mean, 2 hours a night at least for 10 years. I did play drums, and I had that, there again, that youth energy thing. I mean, I watched those, and it is extraordinary. I mean, just sort of, it's not extraordinary, really. Biologically, it's you know, they talk about young men, you know, what are you going to do with all that testosterone? You know, drum kit's a safe release, I think, compared with some of the things we do with it. And blimey, I did go it, and I played long and loud for hours and hours, night after night. For 10 years, that's what I did. Yes, indeed.
So did you, because I know that your dad had a certain influence on you musically in terms of, I don't know whether that extends to, you know, your formal training in any sort of instruments, but I know that he used to take you to a lot of concerts and a lot of live music, classical music and jazz. Is that what led you to learn the drums?
God, you've done a lot of homework, haven't you? I'm very honoured, you know. I'm very flattered by this.
Trying to
blimey.
Keep the bed going.
Crikey. Yeah, that's all true. Yeah, my father had been an amateur pianist. He was a professional psychologist, but he had, in fact, made some 78s in his youth with an operatic tenor who lived in England. And he did teach me stuff. I mean, he died when I was about 18, and he never knew that I became a musician, and I think he despaired of me because I didn't go to university and I didn't really pursue classical music as a thing. And I think I was, you know, a disappointment to him, really. It's a shame. I'd like to be able to see him again. If he could just come back for an hour or two and say, look, Dad, I'm all right, don't worry. And I did learn from you. I just didn't use it in a way that you would have, you know, chosen. But, you know, I did use it. I mean, it did take me to, this is the great thing about living in cities or near them. There are lots of museums and art galleries and stuff. They didn't have money or anything like that, but living in West Dulwich, which is mainly where I lived as a child and then later on a bit, it was just, you know, I don't know, 20 minutes to Victoria Station and all the museums and art galleries And at home, my dad had records, you know, and I used to listen to those. And particularly since I hated school, I was no good at anything academically, which is why I had to leave when I was 16. So art and music were a kind of lifeline to another possible world, although I had no idea I would ever be able to make a living at either. And I just had no idea what I would do. I was trying to think of some, I don't know, criminal activity I thought might... But on the other hand, too cowardly to break the law. I mean, it's not a question of morals, you know, but it must be so scary.
Well, it depends which way you choose to break it.
I know, but I had a few friends who were in prison for various things, drugs and running sort of dodgy places in Soho, and I admired them greatly, but I just don't know how you can live like that outside the law. You've got to have nerves of steel. And I'm too soppy. I can't be bothered with that. So I really didn't know what to do. And I certainly couldn't play jazz because it's too hard. And I went to art college and drawing's hard. And I don't know. I thought, there's nothing I'm capable of doing. So I got jobs for years I just worked in a forest or did washing up. I just thought, well, I'll just be a person who just does jobs and listens to records. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But then beat music came along. And I defy anybody to say they're so stupid they could not play drums in a beat group. So that's what we did.
So it wasn't classical training.
It wasn't the classical training, except the classical training only gave us sort of aspirations beyond our technical ability. So whilst we thumped away local dances, our minds were full of Hindemith and Charlie Parker and Debussy and all that stuff. It's eventually... There were a lot of us, I think, people like us, grammar school boys, ideas above their station, and which led to the sort of dreadful excesses of sort of pomp rock later on in the next decade. But I was always trying to... We can never really make pop records because I was aware from the classical stuff I'd been to, from Beethoven and the operas and so on, that musical ideas, if they're extended and developed... You know, that's where the fun lies, and so I could never just contain an idea in that 2-3 minute format, or very rarely. And so, I wouldn't say what we did was jazz, but we developed more along lines influenced by jazz in terms of exploring ideas and just developing them and seeing what happens.
This is Soft Machine.
Yeah, and just generally, I mean, what I've done ever since, really. I do listen to jazz because. It seems to present infinite variations on themes, you know, rather than tidying them up and putting them in a little box of a tune.
Do you feel you were talking there about letting your ideas run? Do you feel that you have been, unconstrained in being allowed to develop your own ideas, unconstrained by a record label or the traditional roots of?
Yeah, I found that if you're not too ambitious. In terms of like high profile or like I think it's really disappointing when I see people on telly. I mean, I admire all the kids who get on these sort of competition programs to be X Factor and all that stuff. I admire, but I think it's a shame that they're just presented with this idea of massive success or total failure, when in fact, in reality, there's you can live like a cottage industry. You can do stuff that other people will listen to. And it doesn't have to conquer the world, you know. Just find enough people out there who will listen to you. And in Japan alone, there's a small fan group that will keep you going for every conceivable type of music.
You've got.
Well, not a fan group, but I mean, what I mean is that in Japan, I mean that parcel just came in there. It's from Japan. The Japanese, there's people around the world. Don't need a lot in any one place, but in the modern world, you know, international world. Who will support anybody trying all kind of little things, usually. And you don't have to... If you want to get rich and famous, well, then you are... That is a constraint. But that's your own fault or your own lack of education, really, about how to live. If you stick with what you do and develop it, with any luck, you will find people who will sort of get interested in it. And sort of follow you on as you go along, you know, develop it. So I'm free because I'm not very ambitious, really.
But do you feel that you've at least hit the right balance between being free in all that sense, but not having to, you know, not wanting to pursue the other reasons that people have fame, which is not just widespread adoration, but never having to work again and those kinds of things. You know, is that, I mean, you were saying that with the absence of being able to tour live, that's, you know, a huge part of, well, the reason that the back catalogue had to be reissued.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I am very lucky in that we do make a living out of it, and I never did, but that's Alfie again in this multitasking thing, you know, for which women are famous. Another thing she can do is she spotted that the hidden flaw in all the sort of contracts that I had, and called record companies out on it and bluff. You know, she said, "What's all this and what's all that about?" And she devised ways of presenting contracts in such a way as I can actually earn a living from what I do. And it, with the help of really nice people, like, started out with Jeff Travis, and the deal we do now with record companies is completely different from a conventional record company deal. And it just means that we basically share the costs, share the profits, and nobody gets rich on us, but we make a living. So, and most record companies we work with have sort of probably big famous people on their books who sort of keep the big stuff going, and we're grateful for that too. But so I'm able to earn a living out of it. So I'm amazed at that. My dad would be amazed, and I'm grateful. And I can only, I mean, it sounds a bit facetious, but I would not have believed it as a teenager that I could, with my limited technical skills, earn a living out of the music. And I would, although I'm not really interested in rock music, one thing I am grateful to rock culture for is lowering the standards sufficiently so people like me could actually earn a living out of music.
So, you know, you say, okay, you don't have the technical ability perhaps of some of the big musicians that when you were growing up, as opposed to myself and the lowered standards of rock music. But, you know, you as a musician, you appeal to a wide range of musicians, especially, or, you know, everyone from Tom York and Bjork, who you've worked with, to Elvis Costello. You know, what is it that you think speaks to all these different people about your music and you as an artist?
Yeah, I don't know why people ask me to do things for them. I'm really grateful, but it is baffling. I mean, it's a bafflingly wide range of people who, quite often people who wouldn't necessarily take much interest in each other. I don't know. I've got a very straightforward thing, really, at the heart of what I do musically. Although it might sound quite sort of, people listen to it, they might think it's sort of, some of the ideas are far-fetched. But actually, musically, I'm very primitive and simple. It's not very far removed from folk music. I want a tune, words, a tune that I think is a nice tune, words that I think are funny or, you know, just sound good. They don't even have to be meaningful. Tutti Frutti doesn't mean a lot, but it's a great lyric. And I really don't know. All I can think of is that I'm not much of an actor when I sing. In fact, I'm not an actor, so I don't. So people can sort of use my voice for whatever. I will just sing the notes, and when I'm trying to sing, as I say, I'm just trying to sing the notes in the right order and in the right place and get them in tune. And I don't sort of try and underline things or put in the exclamation marks. I hope, well, I like to have music that's good enough, that's strong enough, so it doesn't need somebody sort of underlining, oh, this is the important bit, or this is the bit where I go high and you all go ooh and all that. Just sing the notes just try and get it right. And maybe that's a kind of, anybody can use a tool like that. You know, it hasn't got a particular style written into it, what I do, I don't think. I'm not aware of one. So you can't be sort of pinned down to, oh yeah, that's what 60s rock singers did, or that's, this is what post-punk, you know, fuck you, I don't care, 80s stuff. It's not any particular thing. It's got elements of those, but it's just me trying to get words right. And so I suppose more, a wider range of people can use that. I really don't know. You'd have to ask them. I mean, I'm not very introspective, really, so I don't really know.
Because you have been, you've also been referred to, which I thought was quite good, as the unclassifiable musician. I think that's fair enough, because some people say, oh, he's a jazz guy, he's avant-garde jazz.
I would say that, because really, I'm not bothered about the style. People get terribly involved in, and this, you get sort of almost tribal wars between what comes down to, you know, different haircuts or different supposed attitudes, or, you know, in the old days it used to be whether you were the MM Melody Maker or the NME, and all this kind of ersatz political groupings used to form around various things, which I like all that. I think it's very entertaining, but it's to do with, that's to do with youth sort of growing up, and it's all sociological to do, and it's not specifically a musical issue. Music is notes in an order, along with other notes, and there are universal truths in music. There are certain things that that work. I mean, if I mean, since you've got a recording, I mean, if you go like that, that's a major chord. Now, if it's a major chord, if a folk player plays it, if a jazz person plays it, or a classical person plays it, that's a major chord. That is a minor chord, whether a folk person plays it, or it's very simple. If you want an ambiguously, you want to use that Debussy stuff, you use one of those modes, like all those things. Those notes together make that sound. They're available to anybody. It's not a style. It's just what notes do. And all that is I've used my listening to all kind of things, actually, to find out what it is really that they all have in common. And within that, I will then write tunes, some of which have a jazz solo on, or someone else have a rock guitar on it, or whatever. But to me, the core of the thing is not to do with style. It's to do with some sort of musical essence that I like.
Which is probably what people pick up on, I imagine.
Well, I have... The other thing can happen, which is people... I've noticed this, and this is something, especially listening to stuff over years, where people... There's multi-layered music with all kind of apparently interesting things going on, you know, textures and attitudes and things like that. And yet, somehow, after a few years or even minutes, you don't want to hear it anymore. Yeah. And it's a big puzzle. Why is that? You know, it should be... And if you actually listen... Pin down what's going on there at the heart of it. There's nothing going on at the heart of it. It is all just effects, layered on effects, without a core meaning or event, a musical event going on. And but it's hidden. It's like hidden, like a skeleton is hidden. And but if a music can have any character that really holds onto you, there's got to be something there, you know. I think of when I'm trying to write a tune or make a record, I won't let it out of the house until it seems to me like a kind of living thing, like a living, breathing object, not just a kind of an arresting or charming mechanical device. I won't let those out of the house. I could churn them out by the dozen, but I want living things, you know, because when I put on music, it's not just for oral stimuli, it's for company, it's to be with people that I wouldn't otherwise be with, you know.
We're absolutely surrounded by vinyl at the moment and actual instruments. Do you ever download music, MP3s?
I would if I could, but I don't know how to do it.
Alfie's very against it.
Well, Alfie's got a Mac. Alfie's got a Mac, and I don't know what much she does with it, but... I simply don't understand all that stuff. I think we probably lost income because of people getting free downloads of stuff. And
does that anger you?
Well, Alfie once sent a message to somebody who did it. They all seem to be living in the Ukraine for some reason. Well, not all, but some of them. people who sort of do these things. And Alfie, whose ancestors come from fairly near that part of the world, said, that's a rotten thing to do. You're depriving him of a living. And to which he put down the excellent reply, he calls himself a fucking communist. He shouldn't want the money anyway. Which I thought, yeah, well, that's a direct hit there.
Well, while we're sort of talking about those component things of Alfie and communism, because your last record did, I don't know if it had so much of the political flavouring that some of your music has had, but I did read that Alfie doesn't listen to it because she finds it painful. Did it? And what period of your life does it reflect?
We're talking about the last record.
Yeah.
The comic opera. Well, we've had a rough couple of years, both together domestically in ways that obviously I wouldn't go into in public. But, except the only thing that is obvious is the fact that I just really descended to the lower depths of alcoholism whilst writing this. I think that having hit my 60s, I started to seriously feel that... that somehow, I don't know, that I was burnt out, that I was a husk of what I formerly had been, and that I needed a lot of artificial stimuli to kind of generate the kind of energy I had before. Not that I never had any problem with ideas, but just the bothering to do stuff. And I found alcohol helped, and in the course of that, my behaviour deteriorated, and Alfie felt... not exactly angry, I think, but she explained it, but sort of lonely, because she, one of the things she said she married us for was the company, because she said, I don't get anything, she said, you know, bloody use for anything else, so if I lose that as well, you know, if you're cross-eyed at 6 in the evening, and I've lost my friend, you know, and this was, I think, why it was a painful period for her, and also she was worried that my judgment was going, that I was sort of losing, becoming a...
In general?
Just generally, yeah. Just that I was sort of... that my brain was as incoherent as my speech patterns. And so she was... it was a period of great anxiety for her. And when it was over, when I made the record, I did indeed have made an effort to sort of give up the worst of the habits I'd accumulated, which I'm still finding hard, actually. Without vices. I'm trying to think of new vices. If you can think of any, I'd be grateful.
Do you smoking?
No, no. I'd love smoking, and I would smoke myself to death if I was allowed. But I can't do that. No, I can't smoke anymore because Alfie's has a... That's the other thing, is that Alfie's got a eye condition for which smoking is very bad for it. It's called macular degeneration, age-related macular degeneration, and cigarettes smoke is... very bad for it. So of course, we've both given up. But it's just. I'm trying to think of another vice and that's left to me, that's available, and I can only think of gluttony and sloth.
I was going to say, you could gorge yourself on.
Well, I did just go out about half an hour ago instead of having a fag, and I bought a really pointless bar of cheap chocolate and sat munching it disconsolately on the pavement.
We've all done that.
Well, thanks. You look all right on it. But, sloth, just sort of thinking, I'm not going to budge from here until I'm forced. That kind of sloth.
So was Comic Opera the most painful? When did it feel like a painful record for you to write, or is it only on retrospect that it's...
No, I enjoyed making it. I enjoy it when I'm onto it. There's quite a lot of different things going on. I like to have different things going on my records so that even over halfway through it, there's still stuff going to happen that hasn't happened yet. You know what I mean? I don't want people to think, well, I've played it for 10 minutes, I know exactly what the rest of the record's going to be like. There are great records like that in classical music. You know what it's going to be like, but you still want to listen to it. But I like to have... changes in it and just a whole different angle, sometimes doing other people's tunes or getting someone like Monica Vasconcellos to sing on the second track or on the record before, getting Karen Mantler to sing on it and thinking of things, different things for Gilad Atzmann to do. He's a wonderful reed player, flute and clarinet and saxophones, and he can play anything. So thinking of different things for him to do is really good fun. And no, I enjoyed that. I mean, I enjoy it. The very beginning of things, the ideas, and then the end bit when you're mixing a record in a studio, that's with Jamie, the engineer at Phil Manzanera's studio. Jamie's great, and he's very funny too when we're mixing stuff. It's a bit like Jeeves and Worcester. I'm like a sort of posh twit going, oh, Jamie, wouldn't it be great if we just put that guitar and put it over there, and then you could turn it backwards and speed it up and stuff like that. And you sort of go, are you sure that's wise? He does the Jeeves stuff. It's very funny. Anyway, I mean, I wouldn't exaggerate that, but he's very good company and a useful sort of, he knows what can be done, but he'll try anything. I mean, he doesn't sort of put me down. He's good fun. So mixing records at the end is really good fun. Getting other musicians to play on them and sort of do their stuff is great. Annie Whitehead and Paul Weller, all these people, they're lovely. I say all of them. It's not a lot. It's just a little gang of people. Mm. And, really nice people. They really sort of... And I like getting people to do things they might not otherwise do, Because then you get something that I wouldn't have done and they wouldn't have done. So then you've really got justified the reason for the record, you know what I mean? So all that side's good fun. I mean, writing tunes is composing stuff. It's a bit hellish, to be honest. From the idea stuff is good. As I say, the end stuff is good. The bit in the middle is work. It's the only word for it, work. And I can't say I love my work. I love getting it done. I'm not one of those lucky people who actually physically loves his work. No, I'm not one of those.
What, the actual craft?
The actual craft of stitching stuff together, of trying to find the right button on the recording machine and, oh, God. Driving me balmy. I mean, recording myself here, I sort of plug the microphone in, I wheel back to get something, and then the wheel goes over the wire, and the microphone thing comes out, and then I press the wrong button, and I've recorded something wrong, and it doesn't go on properly, and I all that stuff.
You could put that all together in a compilation. They'd say it was Robert White's greatest and most experimental work.
Yeah, this maybe the last one. Just before I die, I'll chuck it out and then die, and then nobody can get me. But I find that very tiresome. I mean, I don't. There are people who are kind of. I mean, it takes someone like Brian Eno. He's really him in a studio with the machinery around him. It is like a fish in water. I mean, he's a pig in shit. What's the right analogy here? Help me. I mean, he loves these machines. He cleans them. He explores them. He nurtures them. He digs up old ones and says, why do people get rid of this 1979 computer? Look how nice it is. And I envy him that. He loves physically doing what he does. And like some painters just love the paint and stuff. There are aspects of what I do that are physically pleasant. The last 10 years I've been playing cornet a bit, and I really enjoy that physically, viscerally. So it's a physical pleasure. But this songwriting stuff, it lacks a physical appeal of other kind of music. It's kind of abstract, but it's an arduous. I find it an arduous process, I must admit.
How did you cope with that process while you were in hospital? I mean, you said you were in hospital for a year. I don't know the extent to which.
Well, in fact, I brought me back in June. I was in the hospital for most of the rest of that year. And then not long after that, I fell out of the wheelchair, broke my legs and went back in for a few more months. It didn't hurt, don't worry. Obviously, I'm paralysed. It's a great thing, paralysed. Once you break your legs again, you don't really give a toss. But, that was very good. I was talking to my son, Sam, yesterday about that. And he politely, he's very, shows an interest in what I've done. And he was surprised to hear that. In fact, the first record I did coming out of hospital was Rock Bottom. And the reason people thought that I think it, what was good about that for me was precisely that. When you're in hospital, someone else is worrying about, first of all, you don't have to worry about paying the rent, or even going out to buy food or make the beds, that's all done for you. So I could actually just sit there and sort of think about music for month after month. And there was actually a piano in the waiting room. So eventually, after a few months, when you're allowed out for an hour a day onto a wheelchair, because, you know, well, I won't go into it, but you are, you know, it takes a long time to sort of adjust to that. But I would wheel into the visitors' room where there was never any visitors, because the visitors used to go to the canteen. So there's a little upright piano there, and I started hammering out these ideas, scared of losing them in my head. And I found it was a really nice way to work. I'm not recommending to people that if they're having a hard time writing a tune, go and break your back. Go to Stoke Mandeville for a year. I'm not exactly saying that, but I am saying I can see why a lot of great art came from sort of, in the past, from parasitic toffs who had servants, for example. And great scientists as well. You know, they had people who do stuff, and of course wives and the like. And it sort of helps if you haven't got anything else to do. So hospital is no barrier at all to composing. It's because before then, I mean, before then with Matching Mole, we were struggling with, as I say, just the basic things of paying the rent, earning enough money with the band to eat and buy new bass guitar strings. It just sort of takes a lot of time out of actual, you know, composing. And suddenly I was sort of launched into a sort of cloud, abstract cloud in hospital, where the completely uncongested, uninterrupted thought was possible. And so it was actually good, funnily enough. I wouldn't have thought so. You wouldn't think so, but it was really good being in hospital.
Is that why I have to say that Rock Bottom to me does not sound like a particularly melancholy record?
No, people assume it would be. The title, I suppose, and the circumstances. And the circumstances, but no, actually, to me, there's a kind of euphoric element in it. I mean, I think it's there's a sad git to it, Phil, because there is about me an inescapable sad git feel about everything I do, which is I can't help that. I'm sorry about that. It's a kind of what can you say when you're role models of people like Winnie the Pooh and Laurel and Hardy. So, there's a sense, to me it's got a floatingness to it, which is sort of actually reflected in how it was. I mean, it is true that people erase pain and suffering in their minds. And when I think back to the actual daily life when we came out of hospital, it was extremely hard when I really think about it. But it sort of, it's just, I've abstracted it. That seems to have gone away. I'm just left with what we got out of it, which was the record and me being with Alfie, and we got married. And it was, to me, it's all a really kind of heavenly period in my life, actually, funnily enough, that mid-70s.
Because you and Alfie were starting your...
Well, we'd been together for a couple of years, but we got married in 74 when I came out of hospital, the day Rock Bottom came out. And I know we had loads of practical problems. I mean, just money for a start, and how to live and where to live. And a couple of kind friends helped us a lot. Ronnie Scott did. A couple of friends of Alfie's. She had a couple of friends who had the resources. She knew a couple of people who were very, who'd done very well enough to be able to help us, which is like a woman called Jean Shrimpton, who was a model in the 60s, and a lovely actress, Julie Christie, helped us a lot, bought us a flat, for example. Amazing thing to do. And Jean gave Alfie, she was exchanging a car for a new one, gave Alfie her old one to learn to drive on, which Alfie did. So, you know, fantastic, you know, lucky. I consider it a period of luck more than bad luck, more good luck than bad luck. In other words, all the bad luck was compensated for brilliantly by just nice people, really, you know.
And so we've talked a bit about all your back catalogue, but are there any plans as far as you have for any new material?
Well, I've got a tune knocking about up there that I quite like. But,
have you got a name yet?
Oh, that'd be telling, wouldn't it? well, and the only thing is, it was a tune I wrote for Paul. Paul Weller wrote that. I said, I'll write us a tune. I want a sort of a tune, sort of soul tune type thing. So I wrote what I thought was it, and but in the end he didn't use it. He said, well, thanks a lot, but I've got one myself. And that was going to, so on his most recent LP, he wrote his own tune, which is a lovely one. What's it called? I'm Invisible, something like that. He wrote, but anyway, I wrote my own tune for this and thing, and but now Alfie, I want Alfie to put some other words to it. But we haven't done that yet. And then a bloke called Steve Beresford, a great musician, has written us a tune, similar lines, which I really like. Not similar lines, but a similar idea, black pop music of the 50s, 60s type tune, although it won't sound like that by the time I finish with it. But not for lack of trying. So bits and pieces, yeah. And I like improvising a lot on cornet, on trumpet, with all my old favourites, and Nat King Cole and Peggy Lee and all those lovely singers. I toot along here. But what come out of it, I do not know. I mean, I can't say in advance. I'm so cross that I can't get drunk and smoke and be silly anymore that I might just sit here and not make records on purpose. Just to show
that'll them. Show him.
That'll show him. As if anybody gave a toss. The pathos, eh?
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.